You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Heaven's Gates, Hell's Flames.
Heaven's Gates, Hell's Flames. That's the name of my...
Is that the name of this?
No.
That should be the name of the pod.
We should name it that.
Oh, that was the name of the play we did.
Yeah.
Shoot.
Yeah. It came to Australia, don't you worry.
Oh my gosh.
My sister made it to heaven. Hey.
And welcome to another episode. I'm going to leave that as the intro. To my left, we got Bo Bees. To my right, we got Be Real.
Hi.
We just shot in a, we just, Heaven's Gates, Hell's Flames. Are we really going to call it that?
Yeah,
that's so crazy.
We have to.
Yo.
Because the people that, fitting. If you know, you know.
Oh my gosh. I remember I wonder if it was the same play everywhere because I was the kid in the car that was bad and then I got sent to hell.
Oh, in the car crash?
Yeah, in the car crash.
Oh, did you go to hell?
I went to hell.
Dang, bro.
And there was a guy with horns and he was,
yeah, gosh,
he
I
was all
that.
Those things.
I wanted to be
he
in
had,
that so bad.
He had torture weapons. It was yeah. always, what was funny was I remember always in the plays that I saw, it was always teenage drinking. Like at these churches, it was always some kids with like dark lights and they're playing some up-tempo song and these kids are drinking fake alcohol.
Exactly.
And that was always the doorway, the pathway to enter into
hell.
The gateway, yeah. if you will.
And then a bunch of people would be scared as hell mm-hmm. and be like, I should get saved.
Definitely
don't want to go there.
Let's really think. Look, man, in our, like, I was studying for the past week about this and I literally, there's so much information. There's a lot of people that have done podcasts or just this conversation about heaven and hell, whether it's real or not, which coincidentally, like I've never even had the thought of even Googling. Like, I don't know why. I think maybe it's just because we've been told what it is and that's just it. But I'm so excited about doing this that B wanted to do it because then it made me like actually look it up and see all the different perspectives and actually be like, whoa, another layer of this thing that, I thought I was done deconstructing. And now I'm like, wait, what? Like,
yeah.
Just from what blew my mind was just the idea of this guy, Satan, with the horns and with the
pitchfork.
Whatever. Like, that wasn't even our idea. That came from pagan culture. And I literally I'm laughing about it because I'm like, wait, so we were promoting an idea that fully is not from Judaism. It's fully from pagan culture while we're trying to save pagan people, claiming that this guy right here was a created being from God and you don't want to meet him because he's so scary and this is what he looks like.
Yeah.
So we're using pagan stuff, saying it's Christian, to try to reach quote unquote pagans.
Unchristians. Make them Christian.
I was like, wait, what?
Did you think that the pitchfork and the red suit came from Christian cult? Like,
bruh, I just didn't even think about it because 9 times out of 10, when we are presented something in church, we just kind of believe it. You give this kind of authority, because that's what we're taught, mm-hmm. to whoever that guy is on the stage, and you don't really think, oh, they're just making stuff up. And it's not just us. Like, how many human videos have you seen? I've done national competitions where it's
honest,
like...
I didn't grow up with the human videos.
Oh, my
gosh.
That's
a fascinating church culture in America.
We were just saying the play, you know what I'm saying, that we were doing. It was like, man. So we were firmly... And culturally speaking, there is a belief or an understanding of what Satan looks like, that he's hell, that he's the ruler of hell. When the Bible doesn't even say that, technically speaking, he's still living on earth or roaming the earth. He's not even in hell at all. So I'm just like,
it's reserved for a later time. But I think you said something that's very important, I think, heading into this conversation, is the understanding that most of modern Christians today's influence of how what they believe in hell isn't influenced by the Bible.
Right.
It's been influenced by many generations' interpretations of what hell would be like after. And one of the biggest things is, you know, a lot of us have heard of Dante's Inferno.
Yeah.
And a lot of medieval theology has been the thing that's actually shaped most people's modern view of what hell is.
Right.
And it's been culturally influenced. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's just an important thing to note.
Yeah. I mean, a couple other things that I realized when I was, or just like studying, like the idea of Satan in charge of hell, it was Greek ideology and mainly Norse mythology. Hel was actually the daughter of Loki, and she ruled over the dead.
Loki.
Hela, yeah.
I was like, wait, what? Like, and this is the thing that upsets me, is like, we are in a world of information right now to where it's like, you don't have to be ignorant. And I think what upsets me is that I'm choosing ignorance, and it's not even on purpose. It's not like I'm just like trying to close my eyes from it. It's just that I didn't even think to question this idea of where do we get this imagery. And it's funny because we did a podcast about who is Satan, but I never even took that further to find out, okay, but this hell conversation,
yeah,
is it real? Is it not? I literally went did a deep dive on, I'm like, I, every time I study this stuff, I always study from a Jewish perspective and then our perspective in the Christian church so that I can see how it differs, how it's similar. And as I'm doing this deep dive and listening to hours and hours of rabbis talk about hell, like their interpretation of it is so much more like, I guess in line with God, that it blew me away. Like, they're actually fascinated at where we got our, like, where did this come from? Because we didn't teach it. It's not in Judaism. Like, yes, there's a there's mention of it in the Bible, but it's like there was an understanding from them. And this is the one thing that really, that I saw the main kind of like most of them that ended up agreeing on, is that hell wasn't physical. It was asinine to think that you would physically be burning forever, because once you die, you die. The only thing that's real and that lives on is the soul. The soul is not a physical thing.
How does that burn?
So it can't physically burn. Mm. So a lot of the understanding or the feeling was, emotionally and mentally, you are going to be in a hellish state of understanding what you could have did while you were on this earth, but didn't do. And that the shame and that the feeling of like bad, that is what will be the hellish torment. And then when this rabbi said this, this other guy said, that doesn't really seem that bad. Like, you're going to mentally or emotionally deal with this torment. Like, that doesn't seem like bad. And he goes, well, think about, why do most people commit suicide? Is it because of a physical thing, or is it because of a mental and emotional thing? They commit the most egregious thing to themselves because of mental and emotional duress, not physical. Now, there's some people physically where it's like, I can't go on no more, I don't want to live. But the majority of that is mental and emotional. So he's like, don't just overlook like how taxing that is or how crazy that could make somebody feel. And they all said that this wasn't a thing that was forever.
Yeah.
One guy was even like, this will happen for 11 months until the soul is purified. Until the
11 months?
Yeah. It's actually supposed to be 12, but...
And then it no longer exists.
Then you get to be cleansed from it and enter into heaven.
Oh. Yeah. There's it's like a cleansing. Penalty time.
It's a cleansing process.
Yeah, so there's several thoughts on what that hell could look like. Before we get into that, I do want to ask the question is, in your guys' opinions, why is it so important that Christians think about this thing called hell? Like, why is it so important to them? Because obviously it's a place most Christians hopefully believe that they're not going to go. So why do they fight so hard when it comes to, like, there's going to be, you know, obviously I don't feel like a bunch of people who listen to this podcast are really going to be mad that we're going to be presenting alternate, like, theological options for divine judgment.
Right. I'm sure when I do the promo, we'll have people come out.
There's a lot, there will be a lot of people who are very conservative in that thought. And you trying to present an alternate view of that, they feel attacked. Why do they feel attacked when it is simply just their view of hell? What is that in them, you think?
I think it's fear. Like, I don't know anybody who wouldn't be so afraid that it's like, I've lived my whole life believing this is the truth, and you're going to tell me in one day that everything that I believed wasn't it. Like, it's really hard to come to grips. Yeah. Or not even it wasn't it, but that there could be.
I think, I mean, obviously it's fear. We know everything's rooted in fear or love. That feels like the easy answer. Fear. It's fear. It all comes down to fear. But I think there is this thing of not wanting to be wrong either.
Yeah.
Because, like, I think in our, I mean, speaking from my experience and the way I grew up, like, there definitely is that side of Christianity that is that, like, consequence-based, mm-hmm. decisions-based, I do good, therefore I get a good afterlife, if you will. And to maybe consider that that isn't the way that things happen, that actually, it's kind of interesting. It would expose the motives, which, like, the Bible talks about, like, God judging our motives or God seeing the heart behind it. So I guess in a sense, why do they fight so hard for it? Maybe it's an exposing of actually their motive behind it is to be correct, is to be right, to be in the good game so that they get a good consequence for their actions.
Or more so what happened with Marjorie Taylor Greene recently about her being pissed off at the loan. Being forgiven.
Yeah. Loan forgiveness.
But then they posted a bunch of senators who had the loan forgiveness for the PPP. Did you see this at all on Twitter? It kind of went viral on Twitter because there was a bunch of senators, Republicans, they were upset that this loan forgiveness is happening for kids for school. And then they posted all of these people who took PPP loans.
And how much
and
money
they
sorry,
the PPP was got what confused me. That's a student loan?
No. That was a loan that...
could go to businesses, churches, all
you're supposed to
pandemic.
Pay for your...
Got it.
For your people that work for you. That's supposed to be their paychecks. So these people got millions, hundreds of thousands.
And they're mad.
And they got forgiven. The loan was forgiven. But they didn't, like, hold the country and be like, no, don't forgive my loan. I'll pay it back. They didn't do that.
If that isn't human nature right there, or like the traits.
But here's
of
what
like,
it is. I think it's more so this idea of justice. We're enthralled with justice if it doesn't
directed
get
outward.
Pointed at
directed
us.
Directed outward.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's what I think. Because I think if
that's
they all can get in, how can that be fair?
Yeah.
Right.
And
it's
then,
not fair.
And then what's the motivation for me to live a righteous life now?
Exactly.
It's funny because I remember having this conversation with a loved one of mine. And we were talking about heaven and hell. And specifically, we were talking about hell. And I was presenting the option. I said, what if there is no hell? Or what if we all get in? And I think that's also a good question to ask yourself. Like, what feelings are evoked for you if I were to tell you in the end, we all win.
Yeah.
Right. That if, like, no matter how you lived your life, what you believed about God. Because
that exposes everything already. Mm-hmm. If there's an ounce of you that's like, ooh, this, then there's something wrong. Like, you need to get more connected to this God that is really good, that is really merciful, and I think is a lot bigger and a lot more inclusive than we want to give him credit for.
Well, that and I think we're padding our scorecards, right?
Yeah.
So I've never met a believer or a Christian or a hardcore evangelical who had a very starch opinion about this, who didn't think that they weren't on the in crowd.
Right.
I've never met one. Never met one who was so hardcore about hell.
None of them have been like, it's for sure a place that I am not going
that
to.
That I'm not there.
Yeah,
that's. That's yeah, it
if
never
you're talking
happens.
About heaven, it's because you're convinced you're going.
Right.
Or talking about hell, it's because you're convinced you're not going.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
The other thing, too, is interesting is how much this belief of going to the good place, going to the bad place, good, evil, is such a cornerstone, a pillar in people's faith that if you were to start to kind of slowly tear apart what hell could possibly be like, or it doesn't exist, or it is a place here and now, all these sorts of things that all of a sudden someone's faith could feel challenged by that to the point where, well, if that's not right, then what else do I got wrong? Mm-hmm. And you're like, why is this such a focus for you? Because this was never a focus for Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You look at the teachings of Jesus, like when he is talking about the kingdom of God, he's not talking about some eternal paradise you go to. He's talking about here and now. Mm-hmm. He's always constantly saying, hey, the kingdom of God is at hand. It's here now in the present. And so the fact that this was never a focus or emphasis of the ministry of Jesus. Why is this an emphasis for you? Mm-hmm. And to me, it's like, those are the thing. That's one of the things that I keep coming back to, because again, I think at best, this podcast, this episode today is an attempt to present some alternative questions, some other people's alternative answers to these questions, and leave it at that. There's no, we're not coming to a conclusion today.
And like most of our podcasts, we merely throw up the question and don't land on the answers, because we're literally learning on a daily mm-hmm. basis things that we never knew from much smarter people, that it's like we're gathering information and it's like, oh, but we're willing to at least be guided in a new direction and be like, maybe we need to at least be interested in the fact that, damn, we probably looked at this a little bit in the wrong way.
And the other thing for me too is like a lot of these beliefs that have been changing, and for people who've been kind of rolling with the pod and deconstructing and putting things back together and whatever they're at in that journey, for me, the thing that's now been the hinge point, as it should be, the cornerstone for me as a Christian, is Jesus. So there has been much more of a deeper dive into who he is and his teachings that is now the thing, the lens through which I look at hell and heaven and what this thing is actually about. So
I think as well, like when it comes to the conversation around heaven and hell, I think because you're asking like, what's the big deal about it? I think the other thing that would be lumped into that would be a conversation around the end times, if you will, because that they all the book of Revelation, for example, I feel like all of that comes into that end times, heaven and hell. And I feel like when you start messing with that, because a lot of Christians, and fully upfront, I haven't done a lot of research into this. My research has been growing up in church. I have so many questions and I'm so curious. But for so much of my life, it was a fear-based conversation.
Absolutely.
So I wonder if a lot of Christians don't have a lot of information about it because it is a fear-based, well, but I'm afraid of what I'm going to find out.
Yeah.
And yet it's that, well, what if there is no hell? Well, then that's not fair. It's either I'm afraid of what I'm going to find out or it's not fair.
Yeah.
But, and like the end times thing of like, is it, is the rapture? What is that? What's the, is it before or after? Antichrist, all of those buzzwords. I feel like all of this is wrapped up into a conversation that is packaged away for a sermon series of 4 weeks every other year. Every other year.
I mean,
precursor to Heaven's Gates, Hell's Flame productions.
You can dive into this so deep, like, just like the things that I was studying, like I was like, you know, there's, hell is mentioned. There's a bunch of different, Rob Bell says 60 sometimes. I read something on the internet where it was like 162 times it was mentioned. Another one was like 90 something times. But it's always mentioned in three different meanings. The main one I believe was Sheol.
Yeah.
Or Gehenna. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gehenna being an actual place in the southwest corner of I think it was Jerusalem, outside of Jerusalem, where they actually burned all the trash. When Jesus talked about hell, he was speaking about that. And then Sheol, again, like I was always studying the Jewish perspective, is like Sheol, everybody goes to Sheol like when they die. Like everybody goes to, it's really a resting place. David even says, like, I made my bed in Sheol,
and you were there,
and you were there.
Yeah.
So to them, this idea of which maybe you guys agree or disagree. Like, is it accurate to say that most people, especially evangelicals, believe that once you die, like you're either in heaven or you're in hell?
Yeah.
Right. It's like it's almost instant. Like there's no.
Oh, you
period.
Go to the gates and find out which one you're in.
There's a line next to you, and they're taking the escalator down.
Sorry,
you know.
Didn't. The right. Book of Life, the name.
But there has to be
name.
There has to be a place in between, because you know, if
waiting
there
room.
Hasn't been the judgment, then no one is anywhere.
Yeah. So there's like two judgments. So there's that first judgment, and then what is it? The great
judgment day, or something.
Yeah.
The great...
Then you have the great judgment. This shows you how far I haven't dove into that sort of judgment stuff in a long time, because my view of God has absolutely changed. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so what we're talking about is considered like the ism that you could throw to that is infernalism, right? Most Christians believe this across the church spectrum, and they're convinced that to be a good Bible-believing Christian, you must accept a hell of eternal conscious torment. And so out of that, it's they're taught to presume that hell must be populated by the damned. It's those who refuse to accept salvation during their lifetime.
Yeah.
Right? That's kind of the standard which most Christians will believe. And then there's a few other, right? I remember I heard this one preacher who was like, he came in this like charismatic space and he was talking about annihilationism. And annihilationism is kind of, it's based out of that verse that said when Jesus is talking about, he's like, hey, beware of the person who could quench your soul. Mm-hmm. Like, what does that actually look like? A soul quench meaning it's done. So annihilationism is this perishing that's synonymous with death or eradication. It's rendering a full stop to the existence of the unredeemed. So some annihilationists believe that death itself is the end, and only those who are prepared for everlasting life will experience resurrection. So it's like your soul just ceases to be no more. You're done. It's annihilated. It's quenched.
Yeah.
And then only those who are going to go on to be to heaven go to heaven. And then the third kind of branch of some of the, you know, what divine judgment look like would be universalism. And there's a lot of things that actually fall under here. You know, one of my good friends was actually, he sent me an article years ago and we were talking about it and it actually really opened up my mind in rethinking what eternity looks like. And so universalism, right? Many modern universalists believe that hell doesn't exist and that everyone goes to heaven, whatever that happens to be. There's some ancients like Origen and Alexandria and Gregory of Nyssa, and they're often labeled universalists because they believed in the existence of a lake or river of fire and insisted that people are going to pass through it. So rather than that being the final stop for you, it was sort of a purification place for you.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that your soul could now be prepared to actually enter in raw, like full love.
And there's a verse in the Bible that does say that, like in the judgment, like those things that you have done that were good will not be burned up and the rest will be burned away.
Yeah. So there for them, it was like this cleansing fire. That would be a curative chastisement that prepares you to actually now be in God's presence.
Whoa.
Which is interesting, right? And in fact, they said that the fire might even be God's presence. Therefore, hell would eventually be empty or its refining purpose would come to an end.
Man. So that kind of lines up to what that rabbi was saying.
So yeah, so these would kind of be the three main things. And to recap, eternalism, annihilationism, and universalism. And it's funny because I probably lean much more these days. And again, I'm always open to change. And if I'm being really honest, I don't spend a lot of time trying to wrestle with the subject. Yeah. For me, I realize like the heaven and hell that is the most real that I'm convinced of is the one that's here and now that we make constantly for ourselves.
Mm.
But universalism, right? There's William Barclays, who was theologian, professor, all of it. But
gosh, you have so many theologians, you know. Mine's like, I saw a TikTok the other day, and he's like, but, brother Lawrence, brother friend. His kid on TikTok.
But yeah, so William Barclay is talking about Gregory of Nyssa, and he says he offered three reasons why he believed in universalism. One is he believed because the character of God. Being good, God entertains pity for the fallen man. Being wise, he's not ignorant of the means for his recovery. Second, he believed in it because of the nature of evil. Evil must end in the end and be moved out of existence. So that absolutely non-existence should cease to be at all. Evil is essentially negative and doomed to non-existence. I love that. That feels hopeful.
Mm.
And he said, third, he believed in it because the purpose of punishment. The purpose of punishment is always remedial. Its aim is to get the good separated from the evil and to attract it into the communion of blessedness.
Mm.
Right? Like when you think about that, like, and I remember having this thought for a second. This was some years ago where I legitimately thought about this of like, what glory does God get by someone spending all of eternity in hell? That and eternity feels big. So let's take 1,000 years.
Right.
So every day for 1,000 years, you are getting beat over the head with some demonic warlock blade that's
right.
like stabbing you, and you're crying out for water because apparently there's no water in hell and it's hot as hell and all these sorts of things. Like, what glory is in that?
Mm.
Like, at what point do you learn your lesson?
Wow.
And like, you think about
this. And
then
it's too late.
Yeah. It's like, you know, sorry, you made your decision. I mean, those street preachers that tried to reach you on 3rd Street and Promenade in Santa Monica, you didn't listen to them. Sorry. Yeah. But you think about that of like, one, what this guy is saying when he's referring to that, like, what is the actual purpose of punishment? The purpose of punishment is to separate the good from the evil. So there's no glory to God. There's no, like, Jesus actually receiving the reward of his sacrifice, dying on the cross, if someone's just going to rot in hell and be completely separated forever.
And I think a step further, the thing that what kind of rocks me is, how do you believe in a God that will eternally make you pay for your inability to understand life and as it's getting thrown at you and this Bible that has been written so long ago, like your inability to understand these concepts and these ideas that are so massive, so much bigger than us that we can't even verify. And on top of that, the caveat of it all was we were introduced to this world as sinners. We have been given the proclivity to sin, not by us, but by that same creator because of the original sin, quote unquote, because of the idea of creation. So if we're inclined as created beings to do wrong, how then is it just to then punish that human being for not being able to get it right every day, every second, because the fear is, oh my God, if you mess up and you're on your way home and you get an accident, you're done.
Yeah.
If you didn't ask forgiveness and you go home and you did something bad, you had sex before church, out of marriage, and then you die on the way home.
Uh-oh, watch out. Premarital service.
You die, you know?
That's bold.
Think about all the shit that we put on those stages, you know? If you drive home on and you're drinking, listening to secular music, and you die, that's it. That's it. The things that you're prone to or that you created to, and then this expansive grace, this expansive idea of like his goal was to recommune with us, like reconnect. If that's his entire goal, the whole gospel, the whole reason for sending Christ. But you're telling me in a matter of 15 minutes that I make a mistake while I'm not in the forgiveness mode, that this God changes all of his characteristics and then ends up the fucking Terminator and wants to just kill me forever or allow me to be killed forever.
Yeah.
I know we love living in tension, but that shit feels like
it feels
not even on the same spectrum of the same God that we're talking about.
It feels counter to the picture of if God is truly a benevolent God, if he's truly a God of goodness, the story of that, the you suffering for all of eternity, it doesn't match up. Like, you have to be honest with yourself. I remember there was a point where I didn't believe that. Like, I was like, well, no, like, it has to, yeah. And the more that I thought about it and the more that I was convinced of the actual goodness of God, you just think, God doesn't win like this.
Mm.
Like, the greatest comeback story of all time would us to enter into whatever the afterlife is to realize that we all made it, that the actual sacrifice of Jesus was good enough for all of everybody's sins to be forgiven. And, you know, William Barclay, he goes on, he was offering those three reasons why Gregory of Nyssa, and he offers his own arguments of why and it's so good. He says, first, there is a fact that there are things in the New Testament which justify this belief. Jesus said, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. John 12:32. Paul writes to the Romans, God has co-signed all men to disobedience that he may have mercy on all. What is all? Is that only people who get it right in this life? Romans 11:32. And he writes to the Corinthians, as in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny when you look at these verses and you actually take it at face value, like you can't actually put like an actual timestamp on it.
Wow.
Like all shall be saved. What does all mean? All doesn't mean the some who make a conscious decision here and now that, you know what? I think this Jesus thing might be a good thing.
Yeah.
And he says this, it says that, and he looks to the final total triumph when God will be everything to everyone, as 1 Corinthians 15:28 says. And in the first letter of Timothy, we read of God, he desires all people to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth, right? If he desires that we would all be saved and come into the truth, don't you think this omniscient, omnipotent God has enough tools up his sleeve to accomplish his end goal,
mm-hmm.
which is that all people will be saved and come to the truth? So when you're saying now that there are some people who will not get it, what you're essentially saying now is God actually doesn't have the power or the knowledge to accomplish the biggest desire in his heart.
Or the desire.
Yeah.
He doesn't even want to help those people.
Yeah.
Because they're evil or they're wicked.
That's where I get confused, because I think like growing up, it was like, well, everyone has free will. And so you have to, like, in a sense, like love God back if you will. And so that's where I'm like, I think that's where the conversation of like, what is heaven? What is hell? Is that a thing? What? Because if it is this the rewards place, for example, you're right. I can't see God, even if, because a lot of people would like bring a rebuttal of like, well, that person chose hell. Well, all right. Well, then you have the arguments of, okay, so one person their whole life was in a really loving Christian family. Nothing went wrong, was perfect, absolutely didn't choose God. And then you have this person over here that heard one sermon on the corner of the promenade in Santa Monica by someone shouting at them and was like, no, I'm good, thanks. That's their opportunity? Yeah. Like, that doesn't feel like a fair...
Well, exactly. And, you know, the other word that gets thrown around, which I know people defend, this is, well, if I can just live however I want, and then this other person, you know, you've been raised and you try so hard to love Jesus and we still make heaven. Uh-oh. How is that justice? God is justice, right? But I'm like, keep making justice like what you believe is justice. So your justice is, oh, this person, you know, we have states that believe this, where it's, this person did this based on the evidence that we know nothing about, but that they said it was accurate, you know, we sentenced them to death, eye for an eye. If somebody fucks with us, America, we're going to come back and we're going to kill you. Even though freaking in the Garden of Gethsemane where Jesus was praying, he had Peter, man, you're going to have to put the sword down, bruh. We ain't here for that. If Jesus was such a vengeful, if this is the way he gets justice, then justice would have been like, Peter, swing that thing, throw me one at the same time. Yeah. Or the thief on the cross that was next to him, who was about, 15 minutes of contemplating thinking that Jesus is awesome, and he gets to be with me in paradise?
Yeah.
My thing
that
is
would
not,
have, if we were there, that would have pissed everybody off.
To
wait,
be honest,
what?
That's not even my, like that one, like I did for a while, like as a kid, but now I'm like, no, I love that. Yeah. That's cool. And there is a parable that Jesus tells about that, about like the worker and like one person
the one
works
who showed
the whole
up
day,
late.
The one that showed up late, they get the same money.
They get the same pay. And it angered everybody.
And it angered everyone. And then you've got like the prodigal son, where you've got the young son coming home, coming to his senses, if you will. And then you've got the older brother that's pissed. But it's like, to me, that is easier to digest than this idea of like, wait, I find it difficult to reconcile, like you're saying, be a really good, loving God with that would send people to eternal damnation and violence and rape and hell.
Yeah.
And I find it so difficult. And yet I'm warring within myself because I'm like, but this is what I grew up believing.
Yeah.
I need to now go into the research. Like, because to me, I'm like, what does the Bible say? And I know, it's like we take it into context and all the things. My brain.
Yeah,
like,
but it's the idea of justice.
In my brain right now.
It's that every time this is said, then how can God be just if everybody gets in? That's the number one thing that people say. But he's a just God. He's a just God, so he has to do
like as
this.
If he's doing this against his will. But I'm like, he's God.
Yeah,
but that it depends on your definition of justice.
Yeah.
Like, what does
sure.
it mean to God who
but
created
that's the
all these things?
Thing that I'm asking of like that's the thing of like, for God to love the world, anyone who begins for anyone who believes and not perish. And then there's like, they believe in your heart, confess with your mouth, and you'll be saved. But I guess then I think I never really was like, what does saved mean? Because believing in my heart, confessing with my mouth that Jesus is Lord, that I still choose my life on earth, like all its mess ups, but like predominantly like with my relationship with Jesus, I would still choose that whether there was a hell or heaven or hell thing. Like in terms of quality of life, we could go down that track of like, I'd still choose this. Like I love this life.
Yeah.
But like my thing is like the hell It's so difficult for me to reconcile that. And yet, doesn't the Bible say, I know I'm one of the preachers that's like, doesn't the Bible say? But I'm like, doesn't the Bible say that if you like don't have that moment, reconciliation, repentance, what that whole thing, that then there is a hell or eternal consequence for that? That's the part that I find
not
difficult.
Implicitly.
Okay.
Not implicitly. And this is the other thing too, which we, what's that? Explicitly. It's implicit. You're right. So thank you for correcting me, bro.
Featuring William Matthews.
So a couple things. Okay. So one, with that, when Jesus is talking about hell, the only time he actually is talking about that sort of judgment, it's held for the religious folks who already got their shit together.
Dang.
Like it's never like, isn't it so interesting that Jesus never talked to hell to the unbeliever?
Mm-hmm.
Quote. Like, there was never that judgment.
That's super interesting.
Judgment was always reserved for the religious elite. And so, and then the other thing too, which I would push back on you,
mm-hmm.
is you really have to start to like look at these verses. And so, like, when the psalmist says that the mercy of God endures forever,
mm-hmm.
what is the time limit on forever?
Right. Same as the word all.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's
lump
like
lump them together.
It is truly impossible to set limits on the grace of God. And if you are saying that there is someone who can even consciously choose, I reject God straight up to your face, I do not receive your love, and they go into the afterlife, what you are essentially saying is that there is someone who is powerful enough to outwin God's love in the end. That makes zero sense to me,
mm-hmm.
right? Even as William Barclays would say, he says, he's talking about this, of the reason why he believes in this. He says, fourth, I believe implicitly in the ultimate and complete triumph of God, the time when all things will be subject to him and when God will be everything to everyone, right? And the reference to that verse is 1 Corinthians 15:24-28. So he says, for me, this has certain consequences. If one person remains outside of the love of God at the end of time, it means that one man has defeated the love of God.
Mm.
And that is impossible.
Mm.
So it's like, I'm sure people hearing this for the first time, maybe, you're thinking like, well, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That makes so much more sense.
And I think it's so important to really do understand how these cultures viewed hell back then. Like, it was... this scary version of it was way more Greek ideology, was way more like their storytelling than what Judaism actually taught. The one place where hell is, I believe it's one, the only place where it's actually close to the idea of that, was 2 Peter 2:4, where it talked about, for if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but he sent them to hell, putting them in chains of darkness to be held for judgment.
Yeah, things like that.
So that Greek word is Tartarus, right?
I don't speak Greek. What's that mean?
Tartarus, it was specifically, that place is used also in Greek mythology. And it was specifically considered a place for fallen angels.
And he was speaking to the Greeks?
2 Peter 2:4.
When he was writing to them, was he speaking to like the Greeks? I'm the only reason I'm asking is because like that culture that he was speaking to using that reference,
yeah,
that made sense.
They would know, but not only the Jews would know that, like Greeks would know that
now,
as well.
They'd be like, we're going to send you to Vegas.
But he said something like, super key. So that verse has been used before to like, well, that verse, he's saying that place, that hell that he's talking about was reserved for fallen angels. It wasn't
specifically for fallen angels. And which is where, you know, where they talk about Satan being thrown into a bottomless pit. Like, it was an understanding.
Yeah, that one too.
Tartarus was that place, but it was specific for these people.
Okay.
Not for mankind.
So then when we talk about Satan, oh, I guess we did the podcast on what is Satan, because like the story of like him falling the arc, like being the archangel, then he fell.
Right.
That would assume that there was a place he fell to that now he's trying to get his minions. That reminds me of like the witch from the Wizard of Oz.
That's the idea,
like,
monkeys
fly.
The idea that is sold is that Satan somehow goes in and out of hell recruiting people, and that's like his home base.
Like the worst MLM ever.
When it's like not that. You know what I'm saying? It's not that at all. It doesn't say that he's in hell right now, which is very interesting.
Mind blowing. And it's funny because most people have this picture of what hell looks like in their mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then go search up Dante's Inferno and see how that has influenced your actual picture of what you envision hell to be. Like, it's some artist. It's an artist who low key was like, you know what? I think this is what hell is like.
And my thing is like before, we mentioned this before, but like hell being a place, there are some days I wake up and experience humanity here on earth and I'm like, yep, this feels like hell. Like
absolutely.
Some of the things that you hear about the human experience that people go through that have, there's no rhyme or reason. Why did I wake up in a Christian family in Australia that sure I've been through heartbreak, but I am very aware. I have experienced very minimal pain if we were to put it on a comparison scale with some people on our planet, that I'm like, this feels like, would there be a reference in the Bible or the study that you guys have done of like that would suggest that they just stay on earth forever? I don't know. Now I'm getting confused with myself, but like, and this is hell. Like, does that make sense?
Well, yeah. Yeah.
So for me, the thing that I would take is that there's a few things. One is when Jesus is talking about the kingdom of God and he's talking about heaven, very, very rarely, small sliver of the percentage of the time that he's talking about it, he's not talking about some place you go to when you die.
Correct.
He is talking about the reality that's here and now.
Mm.
Or the reality that is to come.
Yeah.
Which,
right.
which
that's
is
also
a
an element
new
of it.
Earth. Most people think there's escapism. Go ahead, William.
Hop in.
Jump on in.
Yep. Most people think that we are living in escapism. Like our job is to make it, to suffer through earth, to then escape to heaven. When the reality of it is Christ was always calling heaven here on earth, because there is the idea that there will be a new earth.
Yes, I've heard that.
That we will live on here. Like we're not escaping anything. He's just pushing restart. And we get to exist.
A reboot.
Here on earth. And this one of these rabbis that I thought was like, this just kind of blew my mind, that he was talking about, he's like, the body isn't living, your soul is living. Your soul just happens to move into a body for a period and then exit it when it's done, and then your body goes to the dirt, right? And I know that's so simple thinking, like, but in my mind, it kind of blew my mind, because we look at our bodies and we see it as living more so than we see a soul being the thing that exists and is the realest thing, not this body, because it will continue to exist. But that just kind of blew my mind of like, oh, damn, like I'm just another way I'm looking at it differently. Go ahead, Willie. William.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about Brandon's point about the kingdom of heaven and kind of that discussion you guys were having about it. I think Brandon's totally right in the sense of the emphasis Jesus is placing on the kingdom of heaven being a here and now reality. And we know this because of the most famous passage of the New Testament, which is the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's really, go back and look at through Matthew 4, 5, 6, but also into 7, 8. And here's why. Oftentimes you hear people talk about Matthew 7, particularly verse 13. And I'm referencing this because we always quote this passage, but we never talk about the previous verse. And I want to talk about the gap between. Matthew 7:13 says, enter through the narrow gate.
Yeah.
For wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction.
Mm-hmm.
We know this passage. And many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. Everyone uses this passage to somehow confirm a type of exclusionary gospel, which is an in or an out thing, right? Like, mm-hmm. Hey, you know, we're the true church, our denomination or our sect or
most people
cult.
Aren't going to make it. Yep.
Most people aren't going to make it because, you know, narrow is the gate, few find it, right? But what we miss is the context in the passages leading up to it. Matthew 4, 5, and 6. What is Matthew 4, 5, and 6 talking about? Matthew 4, 5, and 6 literally is the Sermon on the Mount. It's the Beatitudes. This is Jesus's magnum opus. This is the constitution of the kingdom. So when Jesus is talking about the kingdom of heaven, he is listing in Matthew 4, 5, 6 into 7, right? It's one thought, right? Jesus is having a sermon, y'all. He is preaching the sermon. I mean, it's the Lord's Prayer. It's all the things. When you pray, do X, Y, and Z, you know? Mm-hmm. It is enemy loving. It is inclusive. It is nonviolent. It is forgiveness.
Yeah.
It is blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the merciful. Mm-hmm. It is about being lowly. Blessed are the poor. Being humble, hospitable to the stranger. He is literally telling us to be inclusive, right? So we're leading up into that. And when you get to chapter 7 of Matthew, in chapter 7, the first thing he says in verse 1 is, do not judge.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where it gets interesting, right? Because we always have this thing is, what is judgment? Is judgment good, bad? Should we judge? When do we judge? Should we not judge? You know,
right.
There's that one scripture that says, you who are spiritual, judge all things. Yeah. But Jesus is like, do not judge. What is Jesus saying? I think Jesus is saying, do not judge, but be discerning.
Yeah.
Right? Because here's what he does in verse 7. He begins to go through, do not judge. Why you do not judge? Here's why in verse 12. This is the gap between verse 13 and 12. So in everything, and this to me sums up everything from Matthew 4 to 7. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you.
Right.
For this sums up the law and the prophets. And then 13, enter through the narrow gate.
Mm.
What is the narrow gate?
The understanding of what he just said.
Of inclusion, of justice.
If you can't be merciful.
If you can't be merciful, right? So he's saying, do not judge. Why? Because judgment is reserved for who? God, but be discerning. And here's what he, after verse 13, that's when he starts talking about false prophets, the difference between false prophets, the difference between good and bad disciples. He's going into the difference between wise and foolish believers. Why? Because he's saying, do not judge, but be discerning. And what is the thing that we're discerning? That the narrow gate is the kingdom of heaven, which is inclusion for all. And the wide road is the road of exclusion. It is the road of judgment. It is the road of in or out. It is the road of a justice that penalizes some and celebrates others.
Which is what it rings more true, because we know, and at least the world would look at the church and say, there's way more people that judge than people that are accepting.
Because it's easier to do
it's
so.
It's easier.
The wide road that leads to insanity, as Lauryn Hill says, is the road of exclusion and judgment.
Yep.
We were taught it was the opposite. We were taught that the narrow gate, the gate of life, and the reason why few find it is because it's easier to enter into that type of judgment where you're discerning out who's going to heaven, who's not, who's saved, who's really not.
Yes.
When Jesus is saying, be merciful and do not judge, but also trees bear good fruit, so be discerning and watch for the trees.
Mm.
And just know that I'm taking care of judgment. You don't actually have to judge. I'm taking care of it, but you need to watch it. You need to see it. And this is the kingdom of God. And what does he do after that in Matthew 8? He heals the man with leprosy.
Yeah.
He exhibits it. It's compassion. Mm. Laying on the hands. Loving the poor. The people society tells you it's the taboo. Don't touch that man with leprosy. He's diseased. Yep. He's unholy.
He's supposed to be outside the city. He's not allowed in.
And there's
literally excluded. So the one thing he does was step over all of the societal norms and say, that one guy who's not even supposed to be in our city limits, I'm going to heal this fool.
I'm going to heal him. I'm going to touch the marginalized. I'm going to touch the people who are on the excerpts of society. Yeah. The people that you're that are unholy, the people you've deemed unclean, God is saying, I have made them clean.
Wow.
And that is the kingdom of heaven. The narrow gate is the door of compassion and inclusion and justice for all and love for all.
Yeah.
It is not the wide road of universalism and loving the world and Beyonce church girls. And like, it's not those things.
Dude, that's a new revelation.
That is the upside down kingdom.
Revelation right now, because I've never heard it said that way.
We're seeing
and it feels more true to me.
Yeah.
Than ever.
Because in a lot of ways, I think we are seeing the effects of what you're saying is how much destruction has happened because of
this mentality.
Taking the wide road.
Yeah. And no, it is way easier.
It literally is like, he's not even downplaying it. It destroys lives.
And what's crazy is that we learned that the wide road was drugs, sex, rock and roll, like in church. Like what we got, I got taught that the wide road was loving the world's things. But if I look at the world's things, the thing that's killing people isn't drug, sex, rock and roll. It is loneliness and shame and judgment
and the
being
hell
connected
24/7
and feeling like that feels like hell. Yeah. Like keeping up appearances, like all of that stuff. When Jesus said like, you don't judge, I'll judge. Like our Father will judge. What do you think he meant by that?
I think in Christian theology, it's ultimately saying that in the end, God is going to work things out for good.
Yeah.
Whatever that looks like, whatever it may be, in the end, like there's this word that I'm loving recently, and it's telos, which means ultimate aim. Where is this thing taking us?
Ooh, I love that.
Where is it? And there's a whole study field called teleology around this. In terms of, and religion is great around this. What's the ultimate aim? Where is the goal headed? Where? What are we doing? Right? It's not the why of why did this happen to me, but the what. Okay, what am I going to do now?
Mm-hmm.
Where am I going to go now? And so Christian theology is overwhelmingly heading us in a direction, right? You see the parables again, Matthew 4, 5, 6, about the kingdom of heaven being like salt, right? Or being like bread, right? These ideas that it's growing. Like there's something, we're headed for something, right? Martin Luther King called it the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice.
Yeah.
Like we're headed to, and you know, I would say even the passion for eschatology is about where is this thing headed? Where are we going, right? We fill it with false things or really terrible fundamentalist interpretations of all that stuff. But the desire for the longing for where are we going? And God's, what he's telling us is you can't see that. You can't just, no man knows the day nor the hour. Mm-hmm. You don't know. But guess what? That's why he says, don't worry about tomorrow. This is right before, again, Matthew 6. He says, don't worry about tomorrow. Look at the birds of the air. Look at they doing their thing. They ain't worried about how they're going to eat, where they're going to be. Don't you worry. Then he says, do not judge. And then he says, narrow is the gate. But that narrowness is going back to 7:12 again, which says, so in everything, do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Yeah. Which is not being lived out. I can't. I did a video once where I actually sat and thought about this stuff, which again, I feel so foolish for not thinking about stuff, so this simple stuff before, but I asked the question, like, why are all these, and this was after me doing the podcast with Melinda, who's a Patreon member, she's gay, and she's like, when I feel like God loves me as much, if not more now than ever before, and there was so much backlash, and I started really thinking, I'm like, why are these people so angry. Like, why are they so angry at the thought of God's love being big enough to accept everyone? Like, what does that say about you?
Yeah.
That says that you want a God that is partial to you, not even partial to principle. Because if it was principle, then you would be like, not on the end either. Because, okay, that my person may be bad in this way, but you're bad in this way. So you just want a God that's partial to you.
Yeah.
That allows you to enter into heaven because you deem yourself as holy or good enough and everyone else as lacking, which is why he says, do not judge, because you have, he goes in and continues with the, take the plank out of your own eye before you go and which is basically, he's not really saying, hey, go fix this and then come back and judge. Yeah. What he's saying is there will forever be a plank in your eye.
Mind your business.
Yeah. You're never going to arrive to the place where you're not.
Judgment belongs to God.
Yeah.
He's the only one that's able to give a honest and just decree.
I love that because it's instead of it saying judgment belongs to God, because there's two ways to see that. I just realized that is that judgment belongs to God. And my first question was, so what's that day look like? Like, what do we think is going to happen? Mm-hmm. But maybe what he was saying was like, judgment belongs to me. Like God saying judgment belongs to him. So we leave it with him. Less about what does that look like then,
tomorrow.
And less like leave that with him.
And think about how we view that judgment day.
Stop trying to
think about how we view that judgment day. We view it as one in which that it's going to be sad. He's going to be sending people out to
fear based.
But then when I try to climb into the mind of this God who
tells us
who is everything
afraid.
That he says he is, right? That he wants, like,
man,
be read.
I was so messed up as a kid.
In perfect love, there is no fear, right? So. And in everything that would be saying that he wishes all to be saved, right?
Yeah, that all
in his
to the
mind,
knowledge.
I can see this. In his mind, I can see God being just and saying, I created a world and I created these humans and these humans became evil because within them was an inclination to sin. So they had the deck stacked against them from jump. So the just thing to do is to redo this whole thing and put it like it was always meant to be. So I firmly believe that the new heaven is, we get a new shot at it without the idea of us being able to fuck it up. Because right. It wasn't on us. Now, we have these theoretical first two human beings that existed, and they were the ones that fucked it up for all of us.
Yeah.
Right? But we did not. We were born into sin. We did not choose evil inclinations. We did not choose to be this way. So to me, the just thing to do, if I put something in your DNA that prones you to fuck up, then my thing is, let me recreate this girl without that thing in there. Because that's just. Because how can I judge someone who's prone to do this thing and then they act out in what they were DNA like formatted to do?
It's God fixing a problem that God created, which is in and of itself in one sense is kind of problematic.
Messy.
How do you even
I can't.
How do you even say that without being called a freaking heretic?
And this is why I think, you know, Adam and Eve, you know, as Lauryn Hill says, lives in theory and, mm-hmm. and they're metaphors for the ego of the human.
The book of Lauryn Hill.
Yeah. But again, this narrow gate, the reason why few find it is because it's the obvious choice and it looks too simple.
Yeah, it is.
Radical love, hospitality, generosity, being merciful, being kind, it's just too simple. We think it's bigger. We think it's some deep mystery secret out there in the universe. And God's saying that's the reason why few can find it.
Yeah.
It's because it's the simple thing in front of you. It's the loving the person in front of you.
It's not can you dissect the Bible and preach this thing. And
it is the small thing, like even in the parable of the mustard seed, right? This thing that feels so small is actually the thing that ends up taking over the entire garden.
It's a whole kingdom inside that small thing. And this is why in Revelation, we see this picture of her gates will never be shut. The thing about the narrow gate is the wide gate leads to destruction, but the narrow gate, it's small. A lot miss it, but if you go through it, you realize it'll never be shut. It's open for all.
It does say that it will never be shut, which is also problematic for most people. Wait. So people, there will always be a way in? What does that mean?
Wait.
And you know, here's this other thing in Revelation, coincidentally, that you bring it up. You know, I've always, and I think I've always heard it preached, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, but hell and the lake of fire feels synonymous, at least the way it was always preached.
I've heard it both ways. Synonymous or different realities. Again, if you view those things like, these are often metaphors. Sometimes we get so literal around metaphors.
Right.
Lake of fire, Gehenna in a trash dump, and Tartarus and the Greek mythology. But these are all metaphors for ways of being, ways of seeing, ways of encountering the world around us. So even when we're talking about new heaven and new earth, whether that's a literal thing or not, it is definitely a metaphor to be entered into in the here and now, which means that all things can be renewed, that every ending, and we see the apocalypse, which is the word means the revealing.
Yeah.
Every apocalypse through human history. The first century went through an apocalypse in 70 AD when the Romans invaded and the temple was like torn down. That was an apocalypse. That felt like the end of the world. That's what John was probably seeing on the Isle of Patmos, right? Like this whole like end of reality. But guess what? At every ending is a new beginning.
Right.
At every like door is a, you know, what feels like a close, you open, there's a whole new reality in front of you. So these are metaphors to be entered into first before we ever even think of them as potentially futuristic literalists.
Real places. That's what I'm saying, because like in Revelation 20:14, it says, then death and Hades, which Hades was in that day what they considered hell, were thrown into the lake of fire. And you're like,
wait, say that again?
So hell has been translated as Hades as well, right? In that day, that was very common practice. Like Hades, in Greek mythology, Hades was hell. So in that era, this was a very, it's not confusing.
Another word picture.
Yeah.
Another point of reference culturally for those people.
So when you look at it, like Hades thrown into the lake of fire, which is like, wait, what?
It got defeated?
How can hell be, so hell is not like, it can be, it can
and
be destroyed
in the Bible. Wait, hold on. What?
It can be destroyed? Like, I don't get it.
Same way you can leave the mental prison of your mind right now.
Yeah.
The same way death can be swallowed up whole for you in this moment because you experience freedom and liberation and love, you know, through love and light and kindness, right? Like those prisons can be open from the inside or the outside.
And all I keep thinking of this whole time is that verse. I don't know where it is, that his kindness leads us to repentance. Like, what if the whole thing about heaven is that we can experience heaven on earth because we can know him now?
Yeah.
But then if, like, afterwards, like, everyone gets in, the gates are always open, maybe that is, you were talking about it before, of, like, no man can defeat God's love. Like, no man wins.
Yeah.
Like his kindness, again, maybe that is the thing. Gosh,
you think
brain.
You think of this, of take the hardest heart and put that hard heart in front of God's love.
And puppies.
How long can the hardened heart resist the pure, beautiful love of God?
With unveiled eyes, too, because you're not distracted by the prince of the power of the air.
And that right there is a massive part of it, by the way.
Yeah.
And even in like
the deception game.
The smoke and mirrors. Even when Jesus was talking about in the last days, like, and probably Paul too, who knows. But like Jesus was saying like that the biggest thing, we love listing off all of the like lustful sexual immorality that's going to happen in the last days. But the biggest thing is deceit. The biggest thing is people being deceived and the amount of deception that will go off. And how do you know when you're deceived? You don't, because you're freaking deceived. Like, it's the whole point. But like getting to eternity or what after, when you're like actually unveiled, like that, having deceit come off. You
with
can't,
unveiled eyes and faces.
Yeah. Like that in itself, I don't think I've given that enough weight.
Ask yourself this question, which this kind of rocked my mind. This is a revelation God gave me when I was having my conniption outside. If you're listening to this, and if you do prone to these, this way of judging who's going to be in and who's going to be out, think for a second. Imagine yourself in whatever ideological heaven looks like to you. And in through the gates walks the one person or people group that you said were not going to be there. Hitler. All the gays. Your uncle that molested. Just go down the line. Of the people in your life that you're like, there's no fucking way these people are getting in because of whatever nasty inclination you have. And they walk in. Are you leaving? Are you now going to bounce? Because, wait, I was told this whole time that they weren't allowed in. Wait, I was told this whole, wait, I don't think heaven is what I thought it was. I'm going to leave.
Well, unfortunately.
Or are you going to accept?
Yeah.
The idea that, oh my God, so his love was big enough to get.
And it's not a love that overlooks wrong.
Correct.
It's a love that rehabilitates.
Yes.
It's a love that restores. Yeah. It's a love that takes anything that is tarnished, lost, stolen, destroyed, and puts it back together again.
Yeah.
It's strong love, as Martin Luther King would talk about. This isn't sentimental love of just like, oh yeah, everyone gets in, so nothing matters.
Right.
This is a strong love, a love that no fire, Song of Solomon, can put out.
Right.
It is a consuming fire, right, that purifies the way, the prophet who talks about gold, is it Habakkuk, Micah, talks about gold being in the refiner's fire, that is all the impurities come out to the surface, but what is that central? So when you talk about Hitler being in heaven, we're not just talking about a gold pass of just whatever, nothing matters,
right.
The people you killed, the da-da-da-da. It's talking about what was God's intention in the core intention of who that man, woman, they, them were.
Right.
Right. And bringing that thing forward. God is bringing through time in human history, everything forward, the best parts of who we are. And he's drawing us into that. And he's drawing all of humanity. He's reconciling the cosmos.
Yeah.
He's reconciling it all. The hurts, the traumas, the offenses, the pains, the rapes, the accusations, the disbarments, the whatever. All of it's moving forward, but it's being reconciled. It's being knitted together, and it's painful. And that's why hell is real, because it sucks, because we're in it. We're in it now. We're experiencing that thing of being refined through the evolutionary process.
And what if hell is that revolutionary process? Because we always talk about fire as if it's a scary thing, but kind of like the metaphor that you just used, fire is necessary to bring out the impurities in gold. Why would it be a bad thing?
And so many Christians on the testimony videos in church, like, so this last season when I was walking through a fire, like, why don't we look at that as what if, like, we talk about fires that we walk through in life.
Purification.
It's purification.
That's weird.
The cosmos is, and that's
the telos.
It's going through the cosmos.
Yeah.
The saints and the mystics believe this.
It won't be a physical fire, because at that point
that's
in your life.
That's always been my fear.
But that's what I'm saying. You're no longer physical. That's what this rabbi was saying. He's like, the idea that you're afraid of a physical fire, that you're going to feel this when you are now a spiritual being, your soul cannot feel a physical fire, so it has to be something else. A spirit can't feel these things. So then what is it? What does a spirit have? So you would consider Bobis's body doesn't have the memories, doesn't have the wisdom, your body doesn't have any of that. It stores certain things, but it's supposed to be the spirit in you, or the what another term for spirit, but it's not a physical thing. It's that thing that which continues to live on.
again, so, metaphor,
right,
about an experience that we all feel, and we name it as fire.
Yes,
we name it as fire.
Then what does that look like in a spiritual sense? What does fire look like in a spiritual sense or in a non-physical sense? That's a very like interesting question. But from what we're talking about, that it will burn out the impurities, that it will be a purification process, that it will be something that you can see the other side of and come out better. That's like a freaking...
I have a question again. Because we spend a lot of time talking about hell. What is it? What is that thing? What about heaven? Like,
I don't. Okay. So growing up, it was this whole thing.
I was growing up, I was like, I don't know. I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be bored. Like, you know what I mean? When I was like,
yeah,
just every day I'm singing the same song.
Yeah, what if people don't like music? Long worship service, then man, I'm out.
Can you imagine trying to pitch that to someone that doesn't love music? Like,
I think I when I was younger, I always needed this thing to escape into, which you were talking about earlier. And I realized, like, man, there was a moment the other day, and I was laying on the couch with my dog and with my wife, and we were watching Lord of the Rings because my wife is, I got to take her through the series, and
you got,
and it was just this moment of just like, man, I am here with this person that I love the absolute most, and it was just this thought of, this is the only heaven that is guaranteed.
Mm.
This is it.
Whoa.
There is no guarantee of a heaven after. So we have one life, y'all. Let's make the best of it. And let's make heaven here. Like, that's
And I think one of the most beautiful things that I learned from this deep dive of Jewish rabbis was like, they literally said, we don't spend time thinking about this because it's not, we cannot verify it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like that.
No one can verify it because they're dead. So they're like, we don't waste time discussing these things. We waste time discussing things that are happening right now.
How to bring heaven to earth. How to, like, that.
That you can literally see, feel, know, exist. You have accounts. You have history. You have history books. You know these things happened. So you know how to move forward in them. And I thought that was, like, extremely wise, just in the sense that it's like, it's basically like we don't spend time worrying about bullshit that we can't get the answers to. Not on this life.
As Julian of Norwich would say, all will be well.
Mm.
All manner of things will be well. Mm. And heaven, if it's anything, it will be a surprise.
No better way to end it.
True joy.
That's it right there.
We love you guys, man. Again, this was the beginning of a conversation. Thank you, William, for chiming in. And we hope that you'd be willing to just even, again, we didn't land on any specific thing, but we just hope that you'd be open more so to, like William brought up, resist your initial inclination to judge and to try to decipher who's getting in, who's going out, even to yourself. I mean that even to yourself, judging yourself under these harsh conditions of like, am I going to make it? Am I not going to make it? And just let go and let God be the judge, the ultimate judge. But follow what it said in the Sermon on the Mount where he says, do unto others. It's the simplest, most easiest thing. Just treat people like you would want to be treated. And that, if you're going to worry about making it or not, would be the one thing that you could do to solidify yourself. So we pray you find a seat at the table. But if you don't, you are always welcome at ours. Cheers, y'all.
Cheers.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.